www.ecosystemsolutions.ca. Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah Day, recording from home on August the 6th, 2020. On tonight's show.
Oh, George was so fun. You know, I think that's one of my favorite words to describe him. He was very, very fun. He took his work very seriously. But I think he just embraced the lightness of life and wanted to have a good time.
We're not surprised because that's a system that exists outside of the art world, outside of cultural any industries, and any smaller industry just perpetuates something that we learn really early on.
I can create a universe, and I really liked the idea of a universe, of characters who would come back from play to play, of things that would, you know, speak to other plays while still making sure that, you know, it's a standalone type thing.
My guest this evening, Mathieu Murphy-Perron, creates new work using the neighborhood of Pointe Saint-Charles as his theater. A group of feminist arts organizations talk about something that was once hush-hush. And remembering George Boyd, a trailblazing Afro-Canadian journalist and playwright with a connection to Montreal. Before we begin the interviews, a few updates related to the arts and COVID-19 in Quebec. On Wednesday, the provincial tourism minister announced that cultural events with a maximum of 250 people would be allowed to resume gathering as long as physical distancing measures are observed. Failure to follow the rules can incur fines between $1,000 to $6,000. This is being seen as a green light of sorts for festivals and cultural events, though it was widely assumed that such events could not begin until after the end of August this month. And it's a bit confusing, since on Monday this week, the limit of gatherings was raised from 50 to 250 people anyway, for both outdoors and indoors. And in many venues in Montreal, it's challenging, if not impossible, to welcome 250 people while distancing. The province also announced $6 million in support for cultural venues earlier in the week. So it's an evolving situation, but it looks like some festivals are getting the green light to go and operate. However, I'm also getting a lot of press releases for arts events for the fall that are actually planning to be held virtually. As you know, it takes weeks or even months to put together a schedule and to plan an event. And I think a lot of organizers, thinking ahead, have already assumed that people either won't be comfortable meeting in person or that we won't be allowed to meet in person. And so they're continuing to release virtual programming. Now, later in the show, we're going to talk about a company that isn't waiting for venues to perform live theater. Table d'Hôte Theater launches their new series, On Point, in the neighborhood of Pointe Saint-Charles tonight. But first, celebrated playwright George Boyd passed away a month ago in Montreal. He was 68. Born in Halifax on June 30th, 1952, Boyd worked as a journalist and radio broadcaster. He became the country's first black national television news anchor in the early 90s. And Boyd eventually turned back to an earlier passion, writing. And he wrote many plays. One of his works, Consecrated Ground, told the story of Africville, once the oldest black community in Canada, bulldozed in the 1960s. It earned him a nomination for a Governor General Literary Award for drama in 2000. He was the first African Nova Scotian to have a play professionally produced on the main stage of Halifax Neptune Theatre in 1988 with the play Shine Boy. And in 1995, he was appointed writer in association with Neptune, which is the largest regional theatre in Atlantic Canada. Two of Boyd's plays, Wade in the Water and Le Code Noir, actually got their world premieres in Montreal at Black Theatre Workshop. And as I mentioned, he was living in Montreal when he passed away. Quincy Armourer is Black Theatre Workshop's artistic director, and he spoke to the Chronicle Herald in Halifax about George Boyd. So I got Quincy on the line. He spoke to me, while on vacation, I might add, about his friend George earlier this week. Good evening, Quincy. Thank you for taking the time to speak with Upstage. How did you know George Boyd?
Well, I knew George Boyd through his association with us at Black Theatre Workshop. Over the years, BTW has produced a couple of his plays, and so I got to know him that way. We produced, I guess the first one was Wade in the Water that we did, I think it was in 2003, and then it was subsequently picked up and played at the Centaur Theatre the following year. And then I believe in 2009, when Tyrone Benskin was the artistic director, we produced his play, Le Code Noir. So through that, and then also he was, there were a couple of playwriting conferences that BTW put together about 10 years ago. The first one, one of them was called Since Mama Done Got Off the Couch, where we had about six or seven established black playwrights that were helping to mentor emerging writers as well. So George was a part of that conference, so I got to know him there as well.
And what was he like as a person?
Oh, George was so fun. You know, I think that's one of my favorite words to describe him. He was very, very fun. He took his work very seriously, but I think he just embraced the lightness of life and wanted to have a good time. And you could always count on him for a really good laugh. Super, super charming, super kind, and very open. We would have a lot of conversations about his work or the work of other playwrights that we were talking about. And George, he was very generous in the way that he would be talking about his own work and receiving, I guess, feedback from his work, but also in the way that he talked about the writings of others. Just super kind and fun. He was a lovely, lovely man.
It's always nice when a great talent is paired by someone who you just want to be friends with and talk to for hours. So I understand he had really deep roots in Nova Scotia. That's where he's from. Yeah. He was living in Montreal and had these connections with Black Theatre Workshop as well. The two plays that you mentioned, Black Theatre Workshop premiered. There was a world premiere for those two shows, Le Code Noir and Wade in the Water, which is neat. And can you tell me a little bit about how he kind of mined his roots in the Maritimes for some of his stories?
Well, I mean, George was very much a proud Scotian, as he would often refer to himself. And I guess one of the plays that he's most known for, the one for which he received a nomination for the Governor General's Literary Award, was Consecrated Ground. And so this play, I believe it was produced at Halifax, at the Neptune Theatre in Halifax. And he told very much the story of Africville, kind of, a black community town outside of Halifax in Nova Scotia that was essentially almost burned down to the ground. And this was a very important story for George. He wanted to be able to tell the legacy of his people. I think I'm not sure how long, but his family had been in Nova Scotia for many, many generations. And so I know that when he was writing, he very much wanted to be telling those stories, as well as some others. You know, he also did tell some, you know, historical tales. You know, if we look at Joseph Boulogne that he was writing about in A Côte Noir, often referred to as Black Mozart, but he was he very much wanted to tell the story of back home, and it was nice to be able to have a few conversations with him when we were talking at one point about potentially producing Consecrated Ground. I'm still very sorry that we never got to do that during his lifetime, but maybe that's something that we can do at Black Widow Workshop at some time, you know, so that his plays can continue to live on.
I know it's a strange time to make plans, and it's also the summertime, but have there been any conversations about how you might honor George, or perhaps, yeah, do something like staging Consecrated Ground eventually?
Well, you know, there's definitely something that I would like to do with that. I mean, Consecrated Ground has been on my list for years as something to produce, and it's just never quite made it onto the stage. It was very difficult, you know, to weed shows out, particularly at the time when we were only producing one main stage per year.
Right.
We've grown since then to be able to produce more, which is great, but it just never quite made it. But I think, you know, it was done as a discovery series early on, and I would love to actually bring it to the stage at some point. I think, you know, in this upcoming 50th anniversary season, which is not going to quite be the season that we had anticipated. You know, we've had to tone things down quite a bit to meet with social distancing regulations. But, you know, as you mentioned, the possibility of maybe doing another reading of Consecrated Ground or something like that, I think it would be a lovely way of honoring George. So it's something that I'm considering at the moment. No decisions have been made quite yet, but we definitely would like to do something to pay respects to him.
I'm speaking with Quincy Armour, artistic director at Black Theater Workshop, about the passing of George Boyd. He was born in 1952, and he passed away last month in early July. So he was living in Montreal. Do you know what his connection was to the city, like having been born and raised in Halifax? I'm not sure if it was his career as a newsreader that brought him out up west, or if he just ended up settling in Montreal because he liked it.
You know what? I'm not really sure. I believe when he was working as a journalist, that was out in Nova Scotia. I don't know exactly what it is that brought him to Montreal, but I know that he loved being here in the city. So he stuck around for quite some time. It's also one of the, I don't know how it is right now, but it's always been one of the most affordable cities in this country living in compared to Toronto, Vancouver, some other cities. I'm not really sure what it is that brought him here, but I know that many of us in the theater community here in Montreal feel very fortunate that he was with us for the time that he was.
It was interesting to note, when I first heard of his passing, the first thing that was mentioned was actually his background as a journalist, the first Black national news anchor in Canada. He was the original anchor working on CBC's News World back in the late 80s, which is remarkable. Only then did I learn after about his playwriting and writing for film and television as well. So it sounds like he was a trailblazer. Is he being remembered as someone who broke a barrier but also was writing stories, as we talked about the play about Africville, talking about the Black Mozart, Chevalier de Saint-Georges?
I hope, sorry to cut you off there, but I was going to say that I hope that he will be remembered as being a trailblazer. Certainly, you know, being the first Black news anchor, national news anchor, is very significant. And then, you know, I think you have to be really talented to be able to make a segue from there to becoming a writer that achieved some of the successes that George achieved. And you know, as I mentioned, Consecrated Ground was nominated for the Governor General's Award for Literature, which is, you know, it's no small accomplishment to be nominated for that. And so I think, I hope the community remembers George not just for you know, breaking that barrier as a news anchor, but for leaving us with, you know, with some stories that we can all look back on and read and remember how important he was to the theater community.
Quincy, I really appreciate you coming on to kind of paint this picture of a man who blazed quite a career, not only in one field, but in another. And I just want to say, it's just so interesting that he was telling stories. As you said, it's quite a pivot to jump from journalism into writing. But at the same time, you can tell he must have been just an innate storyteller to have achieved that kind of success in both of those fields.
He absolutely was. He could tell a great story, and he had the most boisterous, infectious laugh that I'm definitely going to miss. I'm gonna miss George Boyd.
Well, I definitely feel like I know him a little bit better, and I feel like I have to pull up his plays and read more about his work. But I feel like I know George through having, you know, spoken to you and had your impression. So thank you so much for sharing that.
It's my pleasure, Sarah. Thank you.
Okay, all the best. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care.
That was Quincy Armorer, Artistic Director of Black Theater Workshop, on the passing last month of George Boyd. You can read more about the playwright in the Chronicle Herald's obituary online. He also has a Wikipedia page if you want to find out more about his life. I'm Sarah DeAy, and you are listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Still to come, live theater 10 minutes at a time, and outdoors. Table d'Hôte's bold vision is ready for pandemic theater viewing. Now, there's a lot going on in the world. The pandemic, the mobilization for racial equality, scandals out of Ottawa, and here in Quebec, a sort of second wave of Me Too stories and accusations, especially in the arts scene. A coalition of feminist arts groups are gathering to talk about how to make this world safer and more accountable to survivors, creators, and audiences. The groups are Studio XX, Feminist Media Studio, La Centrale Gallery Powerhouse, and Articule. The event they're putting together is called We Are Not Surprised, or On N'est Pas Surprise. It is set to tackle abuses of power in Quebec arts organizations this coming Monday from 4 to 6 p.m. on Zoom. Roxane Hilary is the Communications and Outreach Coordinator at Studio XX, and she spoke to me about the event and why it's time for a reckoning.
Good evening, Roxane. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me on Upstage. How have you been these last couple of months during pandemic times?
I think okay. So I work at Studio XX, and we've been kind of shifting everything online, which wasn't too complicated for us because we already had a lot of online infrastructure. So it's been, I think, much more manageable than most of other people.
I wanted to ask about We Are Not Surprised. It's coming up this Monday. What was the catalyst for creating this event?
So we're kind of like seeing, like in that kind of like second wave of Me Too in Quebec specifically, someone was called out specifically in the media arts media. We're not kind of affiliated to him or anything, but we're still part, we're still in media arts, and we're a feminist artist rent center. So we thought it was important for us to kind of like support our community through this and kind of like brainstorm together ways of kind of like taking away the burden from specific people, especially like survivors who are speaking up and or who are getting a lot of like backlash for just speaking up. So we're kind of like, oh, how can we as an organization with like more kind of plus de moyens, how can we respond to this and support them? So that's why in conversation with one specific person who kind of spoke up and who got a lot of media attention, we decided to really support her through that process. And something that she mentioned was really important for her was how could institutions not be silent, and how could her speaking up be the starting point for a larger conversation?
Right, because so often the onus is on individuals to come forward, but there's a lot at risk, right? You kind of, number one, telling your story is a challenge. You kind of risk opening yourself up to people saying things about you or attacking you. So it's difficult for someone to come forward when they have allegations of misconduct or assault. It's a challenge. I think I really love that idea of rallying. It's like a rallying of the community around survivors. What do you think is a major challenge in having organizations step up? Is it, you know, being is it providing resources? Is the challenge touching on something that's been quiet for such a long time? I'm curious from that perspective of an organization.
So earlier, like you were mentioning, the idea that yes, how challenging it was for individuals to speak up, and like the importance of kind of like organizations stepping in. I just want to kind of like underline that by us organizing this event, the idea was really to kind of like underline the fact that this is not like a specific incident; it's the system. Mm-hmm. So, since organizations are perpetuating systems of oppression, like without even knowing it, how can they change their own culture? So what can be complicated is that organizations and institutions are exist within systems that are themselves harmful. They are constructed or composed of individuals who also have their own bias. So I think it's just kind of like for organizations to not simply kind of cut, like cancel people who've been called out from their network, but really the challenge of changing the culture of the organizations from within, which is often a process that is very long and that takes a lot of energy, and that is sometimes it's not something that you can advertise really quickly. And you don't get a direct kind of like the social capital from it. Mm-hmm. So that can be challenging for organizations who are also running in a system that is always asking for quick
solutions.
Quick results. So I think this can be really challenging as well as for us. So we are a feminist artist rent center. But we are not, we started this event, but we're not equipped in kind of like supporting survivors on a more kind of social, like we're not social workers, we're not equipped to do this. So we decided to collaborate with this event with an organization called Calac Tres Pour Elle, which is specialized in supporting survivors through their journey. And I wish that other, like, I hope that other organizations that are taking part in the event are going to start a similar process.
I think it's really responsible for Studio XX to acknowledge that, to what your role is, and that you're not expanding it beyond, you know, because, as you're saying, you're not social workers. And it's interesting to hear you acknowledge that, but also to find the people who can do that work. I think it makes it a really multi-pronged approach. I'm speaking with Roxane Halari, who's in charge of communications and community outreach at Studio XX. I first read about the upcoming discussion in the Montreal Gazette and in a piece in reference to a specific visual artist who had had people who had been in relationships with him had come forward to talk about what had happened. One of the people quoted in that particular story was Cheryl Sim at the Phi Foundation for Contemporary Art, and she had made reference to the old guard or a boys' club that kind of existed to kind of protect certain people's interests and not, you know, protecting what was in the audience's best interests or that of survivors. Would you agree with that assessment in Montreal? Is there this still this idea of there being like an old guard or boys' club?
Well, I think in any milieu, since it exists in a system of privilege, like the more privileged you are, the easier it is to kind of evolve. And for the artistic, in the arts milieu, you do need a lot of resources to make it, and you need a lot of privilege in order to kind of focus on your art practice. Obviously, things are changing, and there's a lot of conversations about this, but I think when Studio XX was created, it was created in response to that idea of specific, more privileged identity kind of taking over the media art realm. And our goal was to center the voice of women, non-binary, queer, and trans people in that creation. Mm-hmm. And we're still doing that today. And I would say that today we still see how relevant our mandate is. So if, as long as our mandate is relevant, then of course there is this imbalance that exists.
What for you personally, Roxanne, is a question or a topic that you're looking forward to hearing being discussed on Monday?
I think we are, so the way we're structuring the event, we're like, we have a lot of people registering. So the way we decided to do it was to create like several smaller group discussions. I would be interested in kind of like seeing how already, like, there are so many resources and solutions that exist in more grassroots organizations or just in a group of friends who started kind of like that system, so for them to be accountable. So I'm excited to see kind of like all the different responses that already exist in our community and see those being shared and seeing like the connections that can happen, for example, from people from dance who registered or from people in music, and seeing how kind of like the different media can enrich each other in that in finding solutions for the future.
I think one of the things that's been fascinating to see in the as we are calling it, the kind of second Me Too in Quebec, is just that it's touched different kinds of genres, right? That there's been call-outs in music and talk shows and on the acting, I guess, between performers of all different kinds, visual arts. And it's not strange, but it's just interesting to see how prevalent the issue is. And it doesn't necessarily only happen in the music world or only happen on the talk show circuit.
Like, the title of the event is We're Not Surprised. We're not surprised because that's a system that exists outside of the art world, outside of cultural any industries, and any smaller industry just perpetuates something that we learn really early on. So that's not surprising. And I, on the contrary, I find it really hopeful that a lot of people are speaking in different industries, but it's not surprising.
Roxanne, if people are interested in coming to the event, is the sign up full, or can people still register to partake on Monday?
So people can register on the waiting list. We have like more than 100 people registered.
Wow.
So we've set up a process for people to kind of like respond to specific questions to make sure that we ensure as much as possible the safety of people speaking up. So people can contact me at atelier@studioxx.org, atelier, A-T-E-L-I-E-R-S, @studioxx.org. And you can also find all of the information about the event on our website, studioxx.org. The event is happening this Monday, August 10th, online. We'll send a Zoom link from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m.
Well, congratulations on already having so many people interested in taking part in a discussion. And since there is a wait list, I hope sometime in the future there might be something similar so that more people can take part in the conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Yes, and I would say really quickly that we are also in conversation with La Parte, which is an organization that works more on the kind of law side, to propose a workshop that would be a 3-hour workshop about harassment in the workplace, specifically for the cultural sector. So this will be coming up in September.
Perfect. So we'll have to keep our eyes open for that. And we can find Studio XX on Facebook as well. I'm sure there'll be updates there when you've got them.
Yes, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, as well as Twitter. And we also have a newsletter that you can register to or register on our website, studioxx.org.
Roxanne, thank you again very much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
That was Roxanne Halari, the Communications and Outreach Coordinator at Studio XX. As Roxanne mentioned, there is a waiting list for Monday's event, but you can email in order to be on the waiting list, to be notified about spaces opening up. The conversation is sure to be ongoing. As she mentioned, there's another event or workshop to come in September. I'm Sarah DeA, and you are listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, coming to you from my home yet again this week. Starting tonight, Table d'Hôte Theatre is bringing scripted live bilingual performances to the neighborhood of Pointe Saint-Charles in a series of 10-minute episodic shorts themed around characters living in the area, all people coming out of quarantine and dealing with isolation and the stresses that come from being in quarantine. It's the brainchild of artistic director Mathieu Murphy-Perron, who is taking great care to craft stories that are at once relatable and accessible, but also safe for the cast and crew and audience. Mathieu joined me earlier this week.
Good evening, Matt. Thank you so much for joining me. How have you been?
I'm doing pretty all right. It's a little bit of a hectic time, but I'm leaning right into it.
To be sure. I wonder if in January, at the start of this brand new year, if you thought you could see yourself in August rehearsing scenes to be set outside in pop-up, you know, performances. If you could have foreseen something like this happening.
No way I would have imagined that this was in my future.
So I was wondering for the development process when, you know, these last couple of months, we've had so many questions, so much uncertainty. So to go ahead and plan and execute a performance piece right now, while we're still kind of in lockdown mode, it takes a lot of chutzpah. But when did you decide that this was something that the company was going to go ahead with?
Well, I started having the idea pretty early. Around April or so.
Okay.
That's when, to my chagrin, there was talk of repeated cycles of lockdown and somewhat loosening of lockdown, which makes any sort of theater planning near impossible because it takes us so long to plan the works that we do, right? I have a work that's scheduled for 2 years from now that we've been working on for 3 years, but you just don't know what next year or the year after holds. You know, you only know when there's a bit of a window open and how do you seize the opportunity of that window. And at the time, the general scientific consensus is that the curve should be flattened-ish come summertime, and that summertime also brought its own benefits in terms of gatherings and a bit of a safer space, as long as, you know, public health guidelines are being respected. So I thought, all right, well, if there is a window that's open this summer, what could we do this summer? There was no way I could do a full-length play, because I feel if I'm doing a full-length play, then I need to have a stage set up, and I need to have a bit more of a repercussion theater type operation, which is not Table d'Hôte Theater. And even then, even if it's a full-length play, it's a full-length play that I'm finding where I can justify artistically and logistically keeping artists
distance from one another, it just, for me, posed too many headaches. So I said, okay, what about short plays? Well, short plays, none of them exist right now, but short plays are, in theory, a different type of exercise of writing and can be done a little bit more quickly than a full-length play. You don't have to be concerned about as many potential character inconsistencies or plot holes or anything like that. So I said, you know, okay, if I'm doing short plays, then I can create a universe. And I really liked the idea of a universe, of characters who would come back from play to play, of things that would, you know, speak to other plays while still making sure that, you know, it was a standalone type thing. And I had, at that point, I guess, two choices to make, right? Either I could write a short play and stage it 10 times throughout the summer, or I could write a series. And the reason I ultimately went with a series was because I wanted this to be so hyper-local, and I don't know what the public is going to be like in Point St. Charles, but I don't know if there's enough of a public to justify 10 performances of the same short play. But I definitely think there's enough of a public to justify several short plays. And we'd only do one. Every play only gets done once, so you see it, you see it, you miss it, you miss it. It's fine. We've got some digital adaptations so that people can enjoy it even if they missed it. And yeah, I just leaned into it a little bit. At first, I thought it would be a labor of love. I would find other actors in the Southwest because I also wanted to minimize travel for actors to rehearsal. But then I was talking to the Conseil des Arts et des Lettres du Québec and the Conseil des Arts de Montréal, and both of which were like, Matt, actually, we're about to launch programs for this exact kind of work. So
right.
Yeah, please apply. And I'm like, oh, okay, there's money. And as soon as I hear there's money, well, then it becomes far more than a labor of love. And even though I can make no pretense that Tableau d'Hôte is, you know, feeding artists, because it's not like the salaries are that fantastic, especially when we're only rehearsing for 12 hours of play. But a lot of artists are really struggling. So if I can go to secure some funds so that artists can have a little bit more money on a top serve and any other sort of benefits that they're receiving, then of course I'm gonna do everything I can so that artists have a little bit more money, so that, you know, if the month is a little less hard than it would have been without the project.
Right, and it's something to put on a CV too, and to show that you've been working through this weird time as well. So why choose to do this in Point St. Charles? Was there a particular... Because you kind of mentioned...
I live in Point St. Charles.
Okay.
That's my home, right? I wanted to make things as easy as possible, not only for myself, but for everybody.
Right.
As I said, I really wanted to cast... I mean, ideally, I would have only casted Point St. Charles actors, but there's not that many of them.
Okay.
So I tried my best to then stick to the Southwest, and I'd say 95% of the cast are from the Southwest, and they can easily walk or bike over to rehearsals, whereas a few are in the plateau. So they're a little further, but they're also biking, so...
Because you mentioned earlier on, not sure if I heard this right, but not being certain about what the audience would be locally. And so in a way, you're on your home turf, but at the same time, this is an experiment of sorts to see who's going to come out.
Yeah. And I mean, like, so far, because people have been so starved for arts over the past 4 months, I am sensing, yes, a very good reaction from the people in the neighborhood, but also a pretty strong reaction from folks outside the neighborhood, which does concern me a little bit. Obviously, I'm not going to tell anybody not to come, but
right.
You know, I am going to be a little stressed if come Thursday there's 200 people who show up for the 10-minute performance. I hope that doesn't happen, which is probably the first time I hope it doesn't show up to one of my plays. Yeah.
It is a strange thing, isn't it, now that this week we've been steadily increasing the number of people that can gather publicly, but at the same time, yeah, you want bums in seats and to fill a space, but we're in this totally contradictory time where we're like, not that many people all at once.
In Tableau d'Hôte in particular right now, we'll see how this goes, but, you know, we in the grants that we put forward, we put a significant amount of the project on digital adaptations of these plays. And I didn't want it to be like live streaming the plays or anything, or a boring video capture of the play where, you know, our videographer puts something on a tripod and it doesn't shake, and then here's a play, it's clear that it's a play.
Mm.
So what we've done is, you know, our videographer is actually going to be adapting every single one of these short plays into short film. And we're really hoping that it is an adaptation. It is clear that it's a medium in and of itself and not just the filming of the play. And Jacqueline Turner, who's been one of our designers on a few of our shows,
is actually turning every single one of these plays into webcomics, which I'm super excited about.
So like a visual, hand-drawn comic?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like a comic book for every play, right? Or graphic novel, or however you want to call it. We're calling it webcomics. And the idea there is that the person in Hosemont who really wants to see these plays, well, even if they don't come, they can watch the video adaptation or read the webcomic.
I love that idea.
Theater, but it's something so that you can still follow this series and follow what we're doing.
Right, because as you mentioned, it's episodic, and you said if someone misses a show, not a huge deal, but you could theoretically miss episodes 1 and 2, but catch up in time for episode 3 via the webcomic or the online.
Appreciate that if there's a character in episode 2 who behaves a certain way,
right,
and you read the webcomic, and then you see her again in episode 6, well, then you're like, oh, she's very similar to that last episode. Hey, and in that last episode, didn't she spend time, like, imitating a chicken? And now she's imitating another animal? Like, you know, it's just her nature. She just loves imitating animals.
I am speaking with artistic director at Table d'Hôte Theatre, Mathieu Murphy-Perron, and he is the writer and director of a series of short plays that are coming to Point St. Charles called En Point. You mentioned the characters. Can we learn about some of them? This is a very topical show. The characters are coming out of a lockdown in the middle of a crisis and reconnecting. So who are some of the people we meet?
Before I decided that it was okay to have the pandemic as a backdrop to these pieces, so it's not the topic of the pieces, but it's a backdrop, which mm-hmm. allowed me to artistically and logistically justify the distance between the characters, I very much wanted the series to be about gentrification. In my mind, I was even going to call it The Gentrifiers, where I had these two characters who were way over the top and who were just going from like place to place in the Point St. Charles being like, we will buy this place and kick people out. And I quickly found that would be a hard concept to stretch over.
Right.
But there is definitely a running theme throughout the plays. There's not a single play where rent and the housing crisis aren't mentioned. The characters I imagined as the gentrifiers are present. They're only present in 4 of the plays, but they're present. And there's a little bit of a struggle between the two of them, where one of them is unrelenting and believes mm-hmm. that they are absolutely doing what's best for the community, even if that means that some people are getting displaced, whereas his partner is a little bit more concerned and worried about what the repercussions of their business venture is. You've got a local, quirky, awkward historian played by Kat Lemure, who just loves the point so much and just always wants to talk about the history of the point to anybody who will listen. You have a couple of lovers who match on Tinder during the pandemic and go on their first socially distant date somewhere along the canal, and what's it like to go on a socially distant date in the time of a pandemic. You've got a gourmet chef played by Justin Johnson who loses his job and finds himself unemployed, but instead of just kind of giving up on himself, decides that he's just going to set up a pop-up sample table to sell people on how great a cook he is, and maybe also to get a couple of extra subscribers on YouTube. You've got a local man named Frank, who's just kind of this grumpy old wise man who sees his neighborhood changing and isn't afraid to call people out when he sees some pretty abusive stuff happening. Those are just a few of the characters, but it's a pretty eclectic gang.
I'm loving all these characters because they sound fresh, but they also sound very... This is rooted very much, you call it hyper-local theater, so I can tell this is very much rooted in the reality of the neighborhood you're in and also the circumstances we're in. And so it's going to fit really well to see this on the street. And I'm just thinking long-term, though, could you see these stories making their way onto a stage and to be performed, you know, theoretically somewhere else in Montreal or elsewhere? Do you hope that these stories have legs beyond?
I don't know if I hope the stories have legs beyond. There was a moment at the beginning of the process where myself and Jacqueline, who's doing the webcomics, but who happens to be my partner, so a lot of my when I need a sounding board, mm-hmm. fantastic in that regard. We talked. You know, do we want this to just be point, or do we want it to like leave the point? Do these stories all happen here? I think the idea of the project of staging things in local neighborhoods for short plays can be applied across the island, not necessarily with these characters, but with other characters. But my more immediate, in terms of staging, it's like, I don't know, One Day at the Seagull. I don't know. It might be a little bit too, I call it straight theater for me to want to do at the Seagull. I tend to like things that are a little bit more abstract and conceptual, which this project isn't. It's got very clear beginning, middles, and ends, and very, very simple stories. But I do hope, and I mean, part of me hopes, part of me doesn't hope. I suspect that we will be in a very similar situation next year, and that we will not be out of this next year, and that we might find ourselves next summer in another moment of somewhat deconfinement.
Mm-hmm.
And if that is the case, I wouldn't mind bringing the series back again next year to the point with new stories where we see what happened to these characters over the last year. So in that way, I'm imagining a continuation of the project. But I'd be more than happy to work with other artists or other companies who want to take this concept and run with it somewhere else.
So the show isn't as simple as, you know, buying your ticket and getting to a theater with 15 minutes to spare and grabbing your seat. There's a little bit more effort because these are in secret locations. Is it time and date to be determined as well? How do I come see the show?
Dates and time are confirmed.
Okay.
So dates and time are on our website right now as well as on our Facebook. It's the location that will be revealed the morning of the performances.
Okay.
Or the morning of the performances, if it looks like it's going to rain, then we will say what the backup date is. We still won't reveal the location, but we'll say today's performance has been moved to this date and stand by for location reveal.
So best thing to do would be to head to the website and sign up to get the email notification, or just to head to your social media accounts?
I personally, my preference would be email notifications as a patron. I would prefer that, because on social media, you know, yes, you can go to Tableau's page, you can like it, but then you can also say, show me their notifications first. That would be one way to make sure you don't miss it. But a lot of times things go unnoticed on Facebook, whereas if you sign up for the email notification, it'll show up in your inbox and you'll be golden.
One last thing I wanted to ask, and there's so many interesting things about this, Mathieu, but in terms of scouting those locations and figuring out, you know, I guess maybe getting permission to be in certain places, but also, you know, can I accommodate a certain number of actors for this week's episode or play? How do you do that work of figuring out your location?
I mean, I was already very familiar with the Point. It's a small neighborhood, but I have spent many hours walking and biking around the Point over the past couple of months and trying to imagine all of these plays in all these different locations. And once I'm settled on a location, well, yeah, that means ringing on a doorbell and saying, hi, my name is Matt. I'm a producer and a director, and I'm staging a series of short plays, and I would like one of my short plays to be here, which most people kind of respond with a little bit of an eyebrow raise, but once they understand the project more, they jump on board. There's some things that have been really fantastic about it. One person, I rang her doorbell, and I introduced myself, and she said, oh, Mathieu, I see you in the Facebook group. I always agree with what you're posting. So that was an introduction to somebody who I often interact with on Facebook, but whom I did not know. Another person is just so enamored by the project that she, when we rehearsed briefly at her location a couple of days ago, she sat up on the balcony and just like watched so keenly because she was just so happy that this theater is happening in her front yard. What's been less fun, especially with the housing crisis in mind, and has just really been surprising. I've been shocked by how many places I've approached that are empty. And then when I talk to the owner, or when I talk to the neighbors will just tell me, yeah, the owner is renovating all these places. They won't be available for another year. And, you know, obviously when they're renovating because the hope is to make a lot more in rent. And it's just sad, given that how many people are looking for homes, that so many of the places that I approached in Point St. Charles were presently empty.
You're almost picking up material as you do this kind of outreach work. And you're also doing community outreach in a sense and plugging your work to people within the community and getting Tableau d'Hôte's name out there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the plays deals with the closing of the YMCA in Point St. Charles. And the YMCA in Point St. Charles was the second YMCA in Montreal and one of the second YMCAs in the network, if I'm not mistaken. It's been here for more than 160 years. And it was a super hot topic at the end of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, mobilization was starting to happen in 2020. And then all of a sudden, COVID happened, and so we stopped talking about the closing of the Y. Well, this play brings it back to the forefront. We're talking about it again via one of these short plays.
One question I just wanted to ask again about logistics. When people come, should they be bringing chairs for themselves, or are the pieces short enough?
That's up to them to decide, yeah. And it will be in the instructions that we send out. We ask that everybody wear a mask. That much is non-negotiable. But if not, you know, I personally wouldn't mind standing for a 10-minute play. But if you're not comfortable standing for a 10-minute play, then yeah, you would have to either, you know, I'll say when there are sidewalks to sit on, but sidewalks are quite low. People who want to sit during a play might not want to sit on the sidewalk. So if they want to bring a lawn chair, they can bring a lawn chair. That'll be for them to decide. We will certainly not have lawn chairs for everybody.
And, of course, it's free, but donations always accepted. People can do that.
Donations are always welcome. There will be a hat that will be there that we will not pass, but that people can drop money into. And there will also be a donation link on our website.
Excellent. I hope that hat is heavy and full at the end of the night. Mathieu, thank you so much. And really hats off for doing something that is out of the box, very brave. And I think it's going to bring a smile to people's faces for sure.
Let's hope.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for talking to me.
That was Table d'Hôte Theatre artistic director Mathieu Murphy-Parent, who wrote and directed a series of short plays. They start tonight. Break a leg. Visit tabledote.ca and follow the hashtag #OnPointPSC on social media. And if you can, and you go see the show and you love it, make a donation. You've been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. This evening, you heard Quincy Armorer of Black Theater Workshop on the passing of George Boyd, Roxane Hilary of Studio XX, and Mathieu Murphy-Parent of Table d'Hôte Theater. A big thank you to my guests this week. You can hear past episodes of Upstage at CKUT.ca under the archives. Thank you to Tamara at CKUT for making sure this show gets to air. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Sarah DeAy. Speak with you next time on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and CKUT.ca. And with that, until next time, stay home and stay safe.
Knocking on the right door. If you're looking for something, well, refreshing, you're tuned in to the right station. You're listening to the coolest station in Montreal, 90.3 FM on your dial, the alternative station, the one that gives you a choice and a voice. CKUT, stay tuned.
Good evening and welcome to the July 29th edition of Grey Matters. Tonight on the show we have a lecture from some time ago. It was recorded in April 1998 in Boulder, Colorado. It's a lecture by Daniel Ellsberg, entitled The Origins of the Vietnam War. Daniel Ellsberg was a company commander in the Marine Corps. He joined the RAND Corporation as an analyst. In 1964, he was recruited to serve as in the Pentagon under Robert McNamara. He participated in a national political crisis in the United States when he released the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret study of the origins of the Vietnam War. Well, here's tonight's lecture, Daniel Ellsberg, The Origins of the Vietnam War, delivered in 1998.
At the time of the coup, McNamara was opposed to it. John McCone, the head of CIA, was opposed. The Joint Chiefs across the board were opposed to the coup. If you wanted to stay in Vietnam, let alone win in Vietnam, you certainly would have backed Diem. If you wanted to stay in Vietnam, then the important thing to do was not to kill Kennedy. It was to head off the coup against Diem.
That's Daniel Ellsberg, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Daniel Ellsberg on the origins of the Vietnam War. The 50th anniversary of the Pentagon Papers has brought attention once more to Daniel Ellsberg. His action in 1971 in releasing the Pentagon Papers blew the lid off of Washington's mountains of lies and deceptions about Vietnam. It ultimately led to Watergate and Nixon's resignation. In this never-before-broadcast program, we go back into history as Ellsberg describes the origins of the Vietnam War. He traces early U.S. support for the French effort to retain control of its Indochina colony after World War II. He talks about U.S. nuclear weapons policy, including threats against the Soviet Union, as well as Eisenhower's offer of weapons to the French to stave off defeat at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. The U.S. later totally supplanted the French and expanded the war to Laos and Cambodia. Ellsberg looks at the policy of supporting Vietnam's President Diem's Saigon regime, first by Kennedy, then by Johnson. Our guest today is Daniel Ellsberg. He was a company commander in the Marine Corps. In 1959, he joined the RAND Corporation as an analyst. In 1964, he was recruited to serve in the Pentagon under Robert McNamara. He precipitated a national political crisis when he released the Pentagon Papers. He's the author of Secrets and the Doomsday Machine. He's the recipient of the Olof Palme Prize for his profound humanism and exceptional moral courage. At 90, Ellsberg is still active in speaking out in support of other whistleblowers such as Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, and Chelsea Manning. I talked with Daniel Ellsberg in Boulder, Colorado, on April 25th, 1998.
The mid-April death of Pol Pot has once again thrust Cambodia and Indochina and U.S. involvement in that peninsula and into people's consciousness. There were a whole series of specials on Cambodia and Pol Pot, and a rather remarkable comment by Peter Jennings, which was, in terms of mainstream media, was startling. He suggested that there was a possibility that the massive U.S. bombing of Cambodia was somehow connected to the rise of Pol Pot.
I'm actually surprised to hear you call that ironic, David. Maybe you're being...
Startling.
I'm startling. Maybe you're being ironic when you say that, are you? Because... The connection has been made for a long time. After all, Shawcross's book, Sideshow, by Andrew Shawcross. I think it was, there's two Shawcross brothers. William Shawcross, right, I know both of them. Made the point, of course, long ago that it had been the U.S. policy that of bombing Cambodia. First, almost surely conniving and certainly encouraging and supporting the overthrow of Sihanouk by Lon Nol, which... had been long hoped for and long planned in some way through the U.S. And then the massive U.S. bombing of Cambodia had been the essential, created the seedbed for the rise of the Khmer Rouge, that particular faction of resistance forces. After all, the U.S. bombing resulted in refugee flows within Cambodia of something like 2 million people out of a population between 6 and 7 million. So a third of the people of Cambodia under our bombing shifted their homes. The society, in a very short space of time, there were comparable refugee flows in terms of size and scale in Indochina, but over a much longer period of time. And that may have been an absolutely unprecedented disorganization of any society, and of a rural society like that, where the people were extremely attached to their homes and their grave sites. It was, in effect, a reshuffling of society, as you would shuffle a pack of cards, practically, in an extremely anomic situation. And it was in those circumstances that the unusually esoteric doctrines, hardly known even to the rank and file of the Khmer Rouge, were able to, and the leadership of that, was able to take power. It was a sideshow, in effect, both for the North Vietnamese, for the Vietnamese, and for the U.S., a situation in which the Chinese, as I understand it, were basically backing Khmer Rouge against the DRV forces. And it wasn't at all necessary or foretold that the liberation of Indochina, and specifically of Cambodia from foreign domination, should lead to the domination of the Khmer Rouge. Of course, in particular, of course, under Sihanouk, Cambodia had achieved a position that was neutralist in more than name. He really had kept his country largely out of the conflagration. And to overthrow him was an evil act, which was intended, planned, worked for by the U.S. I say that to this day, smoking guns, in the sense of conclusive evidence that we conspired to overthrow him while he was out of the country, is still lacking, although there's a great deal of